Understanding that in order to solve the Horizon and Flatness problems, we needed a period of accelerated expansion. In particular, if we want d omega minus 1 d log a to be negative, or d log a any co-moving scale divided by the horizon size to be greater than 0, or a double dot over a greater than 0, all three of these conditions are met identically by the pressure less than minus 1/3 the energy density. So taking either one of these conditions, any one of these three conditions, requires this. So now what we're going to do is talk about how we're going to implement this in the case of a particular model. If we remember the conformal diagram that we drew, which is sort of x and conformal time tau, here's our past light cone from today. And so we have these, for example, light cones from the time of the CMB. We found that we could solve this horizon problem. We could get these light cones to intersect by introducing accelerating expansion, which gave us a negative conformal time. And I think as somebody pointed out, however, that if I have an exponential expansion, so that is rho is equal to a constant, p is equal to minus 1, implies that the scale factor is proportional to e to the minus ht, and conformal time is written tau is equal to minus 1 over ah, goes to 0 as t goes to infinity. Okay, so you have a negative conformal time that's exponentially approaching 0 as the coordinate time goes to infinity. As somebody pointed out, that this never goes to positive conformal time, right? You just end up with a universe that is exponentially expanding forever, right? So we have to make some sort of a transition between the accelerating expansion phase and the decelerating expansion phase. And furthermore, imagine that before this inflationary period, I had some rho matter, right? 1 over a cubed, or some rho radiation in the universe, 1 over a to the fourth. Well, during the exponential period, during a period of exponential expansion, this goes e to the minus 3ht or e to the minus 4ht. And we find that anything in the universe but the vacuum energy, right, this stuff, any other components that act like normal matter and radiation are exponentially diluted during this expansion. So as this goes on and on, what I end up with is, even if I started out with small amounts of matter radiation in my universe, I end up with a completely empty universe that's filled with nothing but this vacuum energy. And so I need to do two things. Two requirements. One, I must introduce some sort of mechanism by which inflation ends, because we know that the universe, early on was radiation dominated, followed by matter domination, and now we're inflating again. Number two, I need to repopulate the matter and radiation in the universe. Because everything that is in the universe before the inflationary period starts is exponentially diluted. So I need to, in some way, recreate all the stuff that's going to form the current matter density of the universe. Both of these can be accomplished by introducing a decay of this. So the trick that we're going to use is, we're going to take this, we're going to have this universe that's filled with some sort of very funny vacuum-like energy, and we're going to end inflation and repopulate in particular, repopulate the radiation in the universe, create a radiation dominated expansion by having this vacuum energy decay into other degrees of freedom. The point being that we need to introduce dynamics into this entire problem. We can't just have some sort of static cosmological constants and create a viable model for inflation in the early universe. So, that is, we need to introduce some sort of time dependence in our vacuum. We need to, whatever this quantity is that's going to be creating this negative equation of state needs to have some sort of dynamics to it. And if we have something that has dynamics and it has the same quantum numbers as vacuum energy, that thing is going to be characterized by an order parameter that is going to be a scalar field. Now, this scalar field may be a fundamental field, like a Higgs boson, or it may be some sort of composite. It could be any one of a number of things physically underlying what this order parameter is. But at the end of the day, we're going to describe the dynamics of the inflationary energy density by some sort of order parameter that we're just going to write as a scalar, while being kind of agnostic as to exactly what the underlying physics is that's creating this order parameter, right? It's just a phase transition. So in any phase transition, you're going to have some sort of order parameter that we're going to treat as a scalar, and then we're going to worry about exactly what's causing the phase transition some other time. So if you prefer, though, like a grand unified, the Higgs boson from a gut theory would be a good candidate for this. But there are many, many other candidates. For example, in brain world inflation models, the scalar order parameter is the radian. It's the distance between two brains, for example. So the physical interpretation of this thing might vary wildly, but we know that at the end of the day, it has to have scalar quantum numbers, vacuum quantum numbers. Okay, I'm going to take a couple of minutes and just remind you guys about quantization of scalar fields in flat space-time to motivate generalizing this to quantization of scalar fields in curved space-time. It has pretty much, raise your hand if you have been through quantization of scalar fields. Everybody? Almost everybody, not quite. Okay. We will, I'll give a lightning review of this, and even for those of you who have seen it, then it will make it a little bit easier to see how we're going to generalize this to non-Minkowski space-times. Because, in fact, we're going to have to be studying scalar fields in Robertson-Walker space-times. And in order to do the background evolution, the basic inflationary stuff, we're going to look at the classical behavior of the field. And then in order to do perturbations, we're going to actually have to quantize these fields in curved space-time. So for a scalar field, if you remember, you have a Lagrangian density. Given by L is equal to 1 half d mu phi, d mu upstairs phi, minus v of phi. Which, writing this explicitly in terms of the metric, which is going to be important later, eta mu nu, d mu phi, d mu phi, minus v of phi. So one thing that's going to happen when we generalize to an arbitrary curved space-time is we're going to replace this Minkowski metric with our metric g mu nu for whatever space-time we're working in. But there's another place that g mu nu shows up that we'll see later. And then we have a scalar field action S is equal to integral over all space and time, the Lagrangian, which is a function of the field and the derivatives of the field. And if we insist that the action be stationary, then we end up with equations of motion for the field that look like delta L, delta d mu phi, minus delta L, delta phi is equal to 0, which in the case of a field with a Lagrangian that looks like that, this is d mu phi plus delta v, delta phi is equal to 0. And for example, we can consider a free field You're right. D mu d mu. Thank you. I had that incorrectly in my notes twice. It comes out right when I write it here before I mess up. For a free field, we have d mu, d mu phi, that is, for v of phi is equal to 0. Which is just a wave equation. So that means we can write the solution as integral as Fourier expansion a sub k x minus omega t plus a sub k star equal minus I k dot x minus omega t, where in the classical case, these are just constants of the integration corresponding to Fourier coefficients. In order to quantize the field, then, so that's a complete classical solution to the free field equation. It's just a wave. We define pi is defined to be d naught phi of x, and we insist on that we impose the condition phi of x phi at some other coordinate x prime I h bar del p x. In order to satisfy this quantization condition, then, we promote a sub k from Fourier coefficient to an operator, and a sub k star to the Hermitian conjugate operator. In that solution now, so those Fourier coefficients now become operators, and it's straightforward to show that if you want to satisfy this condition, you must have a sub k hat dagger equal to del q k minus k star. Yeah. So as a brief aside, now we can look at this and make an analogy here between these creation and annihilation operators and ladder operators and simple harmonic oscillator. For a simple harmonic oscillator, if you remember, in just regular quantum mechanics, we have raising and lowering operators, A hat, A hat dagger, is equal to unity. So this is just essentially what we're doing is we're defining an infinite number of simple harmonic oscillator ladder operators at every space-time point, one for every possible momentum of the field. And so, again, by analogy with a simple harmonic oscillator, where we have H is H bar omega, A dagger A, plus 1/2, and with a ground state, defined by A hat dagger A on the vacuum cap is equal to 0, implies that H operating on 0 is equal to 1/2 H bar omega 0. So we have the familiar result of the simple harmonic oscillator has a non-zero ground state energy because of quantum effects. And as you all know, if we take this now and define a Hamiltonian for our scalar field in the same way, so in a quantum field theory, take the Hamiltonian, it's just the sum of the individual Hamiltonians for all those little raising and lowering operators. That is, we just integrate d cubed k h bar omega sub k a hat dagger k a hat k plus 1/2. And we call the ground state now the vacuum. Is the one that is annihilated by this operator. That means that H operating on 0 is given by the integral of all the ground states, half H bar omega sub k, goes to infinity. Right, so we have an infinite number of little simple harmonic oscillators. Each one of them has a ground state energy. All of that adds up to an infinite ground state for a quantum field. So there's something wrong here. Typically, what people do in quantum field theory is they just say, well, I'm going to subtract off that infinity and we'll be done. Right? Through some trick like normal ordering or something like that. Another thing we might do is say, okay, the problem here is that our quantum field theory is not valid up to arbitrarily large momenta, right? There's going to be some breakdown of it in the ultraviolet. We're going to get some sort of quantum gravitational theory or something like that, or maybe supersymmetry or whatever, that is going to introduce a cutoff on this integral that is going to take this infinity and make it finite. So that we, in a theory with a cutoff, what we expect is that we're going to have some sort of finite vacuum energy that comes from this extra piece in the Hamiltonian operating on our ground state kept for our quantum field theory. So if we introduce a cutoff, so H acting on the cat for, say, let's make a guess that we're going to introduce an ultraviolet cutoff in our theory at somewhere around the Planck scale, d cubed k, 1/2 H bar omega sub k. You work out the numbers. This ends up being around 10 to the 93rd grams per cubic centimeter is the estimate that you would naively make for the value of the cosmological constant. Right, so this would be the ground state energy of the vacuum, which would give you an omega in vacuum energy of about 10 to the 120th power. And we know that omega in the current universe is about 1, right? So the real number for dark energy in the universe today is omega lambda is about 0.7, right? So this is probably the greatest misestimate in the history of physics. But it comes from, like I said, this is kind of an aside. It's not going to be very important for what we talk about later. But it's very easy to do this calculation and make this estimate in this way. I mean, there's nothing more complicated about it than that. So the naive estimate that you would expect if you introduce an ultraviolet cutoff in the theory would be something like this. And it gives you an answer that's way, way off, and nobody understands why. But the point being that typically in collider physics, when I'm doing perturbative expansions and I'm doing collisions and stuff, I don't have to care about this extra term. I can just subtract it off, and it doesn't matter to me anymore. So that from the point of view of anybody doing perturbative calculations that apply to collider experiments, this extra constant piece doesn't have any effect on your results, so you can ignore it. When you're doing cosmology, you cannot ignore it. It begs an explanation. Because this action, this energy density ought to be a physical energy density, and it ought to actually feedback on the dynamics of the space-time. So this is something that is a big outstanding problem. Nobody knows how to solve it, but it's obviously something that needs to be solved because we see that there really is something that looks a lot like a ground state energy in the current universe. It's dominating expansion, but there's no way to say why it's so small. And I think until the discovery of the cosmological constant, until the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe, everybody figured that the solution to this problem was that there was going to be some symmetry or something that was just going to make it cancel out exactly and it would go to zero. But now you have a bigger problem because you can't wave your hand and say, well, since it's infinite, it must be zero. You really have to face this. And I will also note that adding supersymmetry into the mix does not help, right? Because essentially, if you put the cutoff at the TeV scale, you still end up with an instrument that's about 60 orders of magnitude too big. Right, because supersymmetry would solve the problem for you and drive the cosmological constant to zero, because for every scalar field adding to the for every term like this that adds to the energy density, you have a fermionic partner that subtracts exactly the same amount. So that if I introduce supersymmetry here, I get a zero cosmological constant, but we know that supersymmetry has to be broken in the real world because we don't see super partners to the regular particles flying around everywhere. They have to be heavier, and that supersymmetry breaking would then introduce a cosmological constant in the same way. Okay. So how are we going to generalize this to curved spacetime? I'll leave that there, actually. That's very nice. So in order to do this kind of stuff in cosmology, working in Minkowski space is not good enough. So for a general spacetime, with a metric g mu nu, that's a function of your position in the spacetime, we want to do a generalization of this process that takes into account the fact that we have a background. And we're going to consider what are called minimally coupled scalar fields. With an action that looks like B4x where G is defined to be the determinant of the metric G mu nu. This comes from the fact that the volume element, when, if you remember from basic integral calculus, if you do a coordinate transformation on the volume element in any multiple dimensional space, you have to introduce a factor of the Jacobian of that coordinate transformation into your integral. And that, so the determinant of the Jacobian here is just the determinant of the metric, because the metric determinant is what determines all coordinate transformations in general relativity. Another way to think of it is that d4x has to be properly written dx2, x3, dx0, dx2, dx3 is a wedge product. For those of you who are familiar with wedge products. In any case, if you're not, just the generalization of this integral to an arbitrary curve space-time, you just drop this factor, the determinant of the metric. So that's the first place that the shape of the space-time comes into our expression for a scalar field theory. And the second is, and by minimally coupled here, what I mean by minimally coupled is that there are no coupling terms here between the Ricci scalar and my field. Okay, so this will give me the Einstein field equations for my background, right? That's just the action for general relativity. And then this thing is included in my action additively. The most general case, I can actually have couplings between the curvature and the field. There's no particular reason why I can't do that. We're just explicitly not going to consider those. And typically, it's very uncommon to see people do inflationary model building with these non-minimal couplings, but you can find examples of it. The second place that the metric shows up is in the Lagrangian for the field itself. L of phi is 1 half mu nu, partial mu phi minus some v of phi. So now we raise and lower indices with the full metric tensor here. So those are the two places. And by sticking those factors of the metric in the right places in the action, that's it. We're done. We have all we need to do. And now we can go ahead and come up with classical equations of motion and quantize the field exactly the same way we did for a scalar field in a flat space time, but just carrying around those factors of the metric. So that's going to be the same plus. So let's take that action . So just as we did in the case of Minkowski space, what we want to do is we want to say that the action is at an extremum. So I'm actually going to go through a couple of steps in here. Square root of minus g, 1 half. Now I'm just going to look at the action for the field. I'm going to forget about the action for the curvature, the Ricci scalar, right? So I'm just going to take the second term in that and vary it. D mu phi delta partial mu phi minus V phi delta phi. So this is the variation of the action with respect to the field. It is equal to, and we do, at this point, we do the same trick that you usually do when you're deriving the Euler-Lagrange equations for a scalar field, is that you integrate by parts. So you have partial nu, g mu nu, square root of minus g, partial mu phi, delta phi. I'll put that back down in a second. Minus partial nu, g mu nu, square root of minus g, g mu phi, plus g, partial v, partial phi, delta phi. That is equal to 0. This thing is a surface term, right? right, sorry. My apologies, I should go there. That's a surface term. That makes more sense, doesn't it? Right. So yeah, I have this, essentially it's a derivative of this entire expression, so that when I pull it out of the integral, it becomes a surface term and becomes irrelevant. And all of the action, so to speak, is down here. And that results in an equation of motion, an Euler-Lagrange equation for the field. Notice that we have little bits of metric stuck in here, which is going to be what's going to give us a difference from Minkowski spacetime. Our Euler-Lagrange equation for the general case is over square root of minus g partial nu g mu nu square root of minus g d mu phi plus delta v delta phi equal to 0. So that's essentially the general relativistic generalization of this. And this is true for, we haven't actually specified anything about the metric or the stress energy or anything yet, right? This is a completely general expression. You can use it for any space. So now we can leave it as an exercise for you. Say that for g mu nu is equal to a squared tau times the Minkowski metric, first of all, calculate g mu nu upper, g mu nu, and g calculate these quantities. And v show that for this metric, the equation of motion I get for a scalar field is partial squared phi partial tau squared plus 2 over a dA d tau minus L squared phi plus a squared d prime phi 0, where tau is the conformal time now, right? So this is ds squared is equal to a squared tau d tau squared minus dx squared. This is our conformally. D, right. D phi d tau. Minus del squared phi. Right. First derivative of phi with respect to tau. Sorry about that. And that's just a straightforward application of that Euler-Lagrange equation there. Let me write this a little more clearly. D phi tau phi plus. So this looks like a normal Klein-Gordon equation, right? If this were in Minkowski space, that basically this term would disappear. And this would just become a constant multiplicative factor. So we end up with a usual Klein-Gordon equation in the limit that we go to a Minkowski metric. But by including a non-Minkowski metric, we end up with another term in our equation of motion that has that couples the expansion of the universe to the evolution of the field itself. This is only half the picture, however, because, as I said, I still haven't considered the general relativistic side of this, right? So this gives me, if I know the evolution of my space-time, this gives me how the scalar field evolves in the space-time, but I also need to couple that to the equations that govern the evolution of the space-time itself, which in the case of this metric are just the Friedman equations, right? This is a Friedman-Robertson-Walker space. So I'm going to have immediately then so I'm going to put a big box around this because this is going to be one of the two basic equations that we're going to use to solve all the problems of the universe. The other one is that we have a Friedman equation. Which comes from varying this action with respect to the curvature scalar r, just gives us the Einstein field equations at the end of the day, which we won't go through, is that a dot over a squared plus k over a squared is equal to 8 pi over 3 1 squared rho. And rho dot plus 3 a dot over a plus p is 0, where now I'm mixing my time coordinates, where a dot is b dt is equal to 1 over a d tau with respect to conformal time. So I can rewrite these things, this Friedman equation, in terms of the conformal time. Which is going to be more convenient for us at the end of the day. One of the things we're going to do is we're going to swap back and forth pretty freely between coordinate and conformal time, for whichever one is more convenient. But let me write down the Friedman equations in conformal time. I'll do that in a second once we define the stress energy of the field, actually. So the point being that in order to use this equation, in order to figure out what the evolution A of t is as a function of the field, we need to know the energy density and the pressure of the field. Right? So these things, rho and p, are going to end up coupling into the curvature through the stress energy. Okay, so this field will create a stress energy. That stress energy is the thing that curves the space-time, and that's the stuff that comes into the right-hand side of the Einstein field equation. So the stress energy for the field for an arbitrary scalar field, you write the stress energy as E mu nu is equal to E mu phi minus the Lagrangian times the metric. So this is a simple generalization of what you do in the case of Minkowski space, where in a flat space time you would write this as eta mu nu, and this would give you the stress energy of a scalar field in Minkowski space time. You just replace that with the full metric of your space time, and that's your stress energy. And for a metric that looks like that, it is straightforward to show that this is 1 over a to the fourth tau, eta mu alpha, eta mu beta, minus 1 half, eta get a nu, get an alpha beta, partial alpha phi, partial beta phi, minus eta u nu, a squared tau, times v phi. Where eta is an Minkowski metric. Right, so I'm assuming that gd nu is given by this form here. You can now see why it's convenient to use the conformal time when you're doing quantum field theory, because you end up with these nice compact expressions involving the Minkowski metric. If I use the standard form with the coordinate, then these expressions can become a lot more complicated. That's complicated enough. So in particular, we can write T00 is 1 over a to the 4th tau, 1 half partial phi partial tau squared, plus 1 half gradient of phi squared, plus a squared tau v of phi. T0i is minus 1 over a to the 4th. Partial phi, partial tau, gradient of phi, the ith component of that, and Tij is equal to 1 over a to the 4th tau, 1 half partial phi, partial tau squared, phi delta ij plus gradient phi I gradient phi j. All right, so that's a complete expression for all the components of the stress energy tensor. Which looks like a pretty complicated mess that we're not, it's going to be difficult to write down in the form of just a pressure and energy density, right? This doesn't quite look like what we're trying to fit into the Friedman equation. That's because essentially that the Friedman equation, when you derive this, you assume homogeneity and isotropy, right? So that in particular, you had better not have any spatial gradients in the field if you're talking about a Robertson-Walker solution, right? Because those would violate homogeneity and isotropy. So in order to make contact with cosmological solutions, what we're going to do is we're going to take homogeneous field modes. We're going to take modes with no gradient in the field, because otherwise we don't have a Robertson-Walker equation to work with. This will end up being self-consistent, because in an inflationary period, gradients are exponentially diluted. Okay. So at the end of the day, once we have an inflationary model, once you get inflation started, if there's any tiny gradient in the field, what happens is it ends up being proportional to factors of 1 over the scale factor A, and they get exponentially small relative to the homogeneous nodes. So therefore, what we're going to do in Robertson-Walker space is we're going to take all gradients of the field to be small, and this simplifies our life considerably, because we see, for example, that all of the off-diagonal terms in that expression, in this expression here, are going to vanish. Anything that is off-diagonal in the stress-energy tensor is proportional to the component of the gradient field. So we have off-diagonal terms vanish, 0, and we are left with t 0, 0 is equal to 1 over a to the 4th tau, 1 half partial phi partial tau squared plus a squared tau via phi. And Tij is equal to 1 over a to the 4th tau, 1 half partial phi partial tau squared minus a squared via phi, a squared tau explicitly. And this is I'll leave that like that for the moment. So now we have a completely diagonal stress energy tensor, which is very nice. And it is very straightforward to identify these things with the energy density and the pressure as follows. We know that for g mu nu is equal to a squared tau eta mu nu, that t mu upper nu lower is rho minus p minus the pressure, which means that here we have calculated t with both upstairs indices. You find that t mu nu upper is 1 over a squared rho p p p1. So taking into account that factor of a squared here, what we have immediately is this is equal to rho over a squared. This is the pressure over a squared. So in fact, if we consider a scalar field with zero gradients, the homogeneous mode of any scalar, we end up with a perfect fluid of exactly the form we're looking for to plug into the treatment equation. That was all a really big mouthful, I know. Are there any questions about this? It's just turning the crank. So then at the end of the day, we have rho is 1 over 2 a squared d phi tau squared plus d phi, and the pressure 1 over 2 a squared d phi d tau squared minus e of phi. And you can see immediately how we're going to use this to implement an inflation model. If we want to have accelerating expansion, very negative pressure, what are we going to do with this?
Small.
Exactly, because if d phi by d tau is much, much less than v of phi for to be a little bit more precise with that, then we have that p is approximately equal to minus rho. because the sign on the kinetic term in both of these is the same. So when we're dominated by the kinetic term, we have a stiff fluid, T is equal to rho. But when we're dominated by the potential term, because these things have opposite signs on them, we have a vacuum-like solution, P is like fluid like minus rho. So by construction, we can see that if we just take a homogeneous mode of a scalar field, it provides us a very natural way for implementing this kind of negative equation of state that we need in order to get an accelerating expansion in the early universe. So we can then write the Friedman equation. Now that we have the energy density and the pressure, we can write the Friedman equation. And I will write these down in terms of the coordinate time and the conformal time separately for you so that you have both available. The one in terms of the coordinate time is the one you'll see a lot more often in the literature, but the conformal time one is because of the fact that it's a lot more convenient to do this derivation in the conformal time. It's good to see it in that notation as well. What I do with the erasing. And I'm going to write this down for flat space-time, which in fact, right, by writing the metric in this way, we have already assumed that we're working in a flat space-time. All right. This is only true for k is equal to 0 or omega is equal to infinity. In principle, you can go through this entire exercise in a non-flat space-time, but only if you're really into self-abuse. So in this case of a flat space-time, the FRW equation becomes 1 over a squared, dA, d tau squared, equals 8 pi, 3, m Planck squared, a squared, v of phi, plus 1 half, phi, tau squared, and 1 over a, b squared a, b tau squared, minus 1 over a squared, dA, b tau squared, is equal to 8 pi, Planck squared, a squared, v of phi, minus phi, tau squared, and the equation of motion for the field is e squared phi d tau squared plus 2a h phi tau plus a squared d prime phi equals 0, where h is a dot over a is equal to 1 over a squared dA d tau. So expressed in the conformal time, this is a complete set of equations of motion for scalar field and the background space-time and the coupling between the two. Notice that we're assuming a universe that is full of nothing but scalar field, right? This is a single component. Model, let's just write these down in terms of the coordinate time. is A D tau. We have that A dot over A squared is equal to A through I, 3 Planck squared, 1 half phi dot squared plus B of phi, where rho is 1 half phi dot squared plus B of phi, P is equal to 1 half phi dot squared minus B of phi, and phi double dot plus 3 H phi dot plus B prime phi. So these are actually a lot simpler in terms of the coordinate than they are in terms of the conformal time. So these two equations, 1 and 2, are just coordinate transformations on this equation and that equation there. Remember that as we said at the beginning that these three this corresponds to the two Friedmann equations that come from the Einstein field equations. This equation corresponds to stress energy conservation. These are not all three independent equations. We only need to take two of them. So most of the time, it's most convenient to take this one and this one. And then this is no longer an independent equation. We don't need to consider it.
So we have three in this equation motion?
Down here? No, it's a two. Work through it. And we see immediately that as phi dot goes to 0, p goes to minus rho. And we have inflation. So what we want to do is we want to look for physical situations in which essentially the field is in a static configuration where it's sitting and not moving very much. And in that case, we will get exactly the kind of equation of state that we need for an accelerating expansion.
Take phi dot zero, don't you have an oscillating universe? But then you have phi double dot equal is not the same time.
We'll get to that. That's a good point. So if I take phi dot goes to zero, then I should have a phi double dot term will dominate there, and I'll have oscillatory solution, right? And we certainly don't want that, because then we're not going to be dominated by the potential anymore, right? What we're going to do instead is look at what's called a slow roll solution, in which essentially I can say this, and well, let's talk about that first. So how are we going to do this? Qualitatively, how are we going to create this solution such that we have a negative equation of state? Because naively, you're right, if I just get rid of this term, I have an oscillatory solution that's not going to work very well. It's not a static solution in general. So qualitatively, what we want to do here is phi v of phi. The name of the game is going to be the only physical thing that we have control over, right? When we build our model, we write down a Lagrangian for our scalar field. The thing that we have control over, the thing that we're allowed to change from model to model, is the potential. That's the only thing that I have in my Lagrangian, right? Because L is, I don't have a Lagrangian anymore, but L is just a kinetic term and a potential term. So if I take L is equal to 1 half dv and phi, dv and phi, minus v of phi, I have two choices here for model building. One is I can mess with the kinetic term. Or the other is I can mess with the potential. Typically, what people do is mess with the potential, right? You add mass terms, couplings, all that kind of stuff. This is a standard thing in any sort of model building. In field theory, what you do is you define all the interactions of this thing. And in this case, they're all self-interactions. But you define your model by exactly how you write, you know, so that you can have V of phi looks like 1 half m squared phi squared plus lambda, phi to the fourth, plus non-renormalizable terms, right? So this is exactly how you would build any given scalar field theory. So typically what people do in inflationary model building is they pick different choices of the potential and find ones that give you behavior that you want. It is also possible to use, to mess with this, to come up with non-canonical kinetic terms, to actually have some, introduce some function of phi and phi dot into this kinetic piece and get inflationary equations to state that way. Those models are less common, but one of the sort of recent and interesting examples of it is called DDI inflation, in which you have string theory motivated modifications to the kinetic terms, and you can accomplish inflation that way. We are not going to talk about non-canonical kinetic terms of inflation, but there's a large and very interesting recent literature on the subject. One of the guys who's written a lot about it is sitting over there. Hi. But what we're going to do is we're just going to play games with the potential, all right? So what kind of a potential is going to give us this behavior that we want? Well, let's just take, you know, let's take a look at a spontaneous symmetry breaking potential, something like that. Okay, this is what you would expect for the Higgs boson in the standard model or something like that, right? So we know that this is a pretty typical form for a scalar field potential in regular particle physics, so let's see what we can do with it here. And we're going to adjust this so that the vacuum energy vanishes in the true vacuum. And the thing that's going to work for us is, now remember, in order to make these guys small, what do we need to do with, what characteristic of the potential is going to make the kinetic pieces small from this equation of motion?
Slope is not the pi.
Right, if we want phi dot and phi double dot to be small, we want v prime to be small, right? We want it to have a small slope, right? Because if I just have, for example, if I'm sitting at the bottom of a potential in a regular vacuum, which is where all perturbative quantum field theory is done here, right? You're sitting at the minimum of whatever the potential for the Higgs is, for example, in the standard model, right? So in the standard model, what you do is you put the Higgs field there, and you do perturbation theory around that point. And at that point, right, at the minimum, v prime of phi is equal to 0. So the classical solution to the equation of motion is that phi dot is phi double dot is equal to 0. The field just sits there. That's trivial from that equation of motion up there. If I set v prime of phi to 0, then that's the trivial solution. I also have oscillatory solutions about that minimum that correspond to excitations of the field. So that if I have a non-zero occupation number, what that means is that I have the field is perturbed about that minimum. And so the oscillatory solution that we identified before is just essentially the perturbative solutions from regular quantum field theory. There are non-perturbative solutions too, but we're not going to talk about those too much. They actually can come into inflationary solutions in what's called topological inflation, where you actually have a topological defect to the vacuum energy inside, and you can create inflation that way. What we're going to do is look at the behavior of the field up here, where v prime of phi is also very small. Okay, so if I am, instead of being about the perturbative vacuum, if I am way up here by the false vacuum of my Higgs field, my field can be, there's a very tiny little slope, this thing is rolling along like that, and this is the region in which we're going to be looking for inflationary solutions. Because, in particular, if I take v prime of phi to be very small, I come up with what's called a slow roll approximation. So the first thing is I want the derivative of the potential to be in some sense small, and we'll make that more quantitative in a minute. Let's look at h squared if a dot over a squared is equal to 8 pi 3 1 squared phi dot squared would be a phi, and phi double dot plus 3 h phi dot c prime phi is equal to 0. So about the perturbative vacuum down here, basically I have phi dot is equal to 0, and I end up with an equation of motion that gives me an oscillatory solution. In contrast, up near the false vacuum, I can identify a self-consistent solution by taking phi dot squared to be very small in that, so that I have a dot over a squared is approximately equal to v of phi. And I'm also going to approximate that the evolution of my field is dominated by this friction term. Right? So unlike in Minkowski space, right? In Minkowski space, when I have an instability around a false vacuum like this, you can very easily show that what I get are exponentially growing solutions for phi. This thing, this is a standard, a spinodal instability in Minkowski space means that phi grows exponentially and goes down to the true vacuum, which is what you're used to. The trick is that in a Robertson-Walker spacetime, I have this extra friction term. So unlike in Minkowski space, where I'm rolling off of a false vacuum into the true vacuum of a Higgs field, I have an extra term that essentially this thing is not rolling off. It's like it's rolling off in molasses. It's got a friction term from the expansion of the universe. And under the correct circumstances, if the universe is expanding quickly enough, that is, if H is big enough, this is my Hubble constant. If H is big enough, then this term can dominate over the acceleration term. And what I have is that phi dot is proportional to v prime of phi. And I have a slowly rolling field where this thing is going very, very slowly off that maximum, and I have something that's dominated by the potential, and then I have an inflationary space-time. And pretty much, virtually every inflationary model that you're going to see is going to incorporate this kind of behavior in one way or another. Does that make sense? More formally, we can write the slow-roll approximation in a slightly more quantitative way. In order for that to work, we must have that 1 half phi dot squared must be much less than v of phi. You know, that's from the Friedman equation up here, right? So taking this approximation results in this inequality. And from ignoring the phi double dot term in the equation of motion, we must have phi double dot is much, much less than 3h phi dot. You can show that these equations, you can use these inequalities to transform them into inequalities concerning the potential that v prime of phi over v of phi has to be much, much less than the square root of 48 pi, and m flat squared v double prime of phi over v of phi has to be much, much less 24 pi. Yes, I will. Question is, can I give an example of a potential that does this? We will do that. Okay. I'm not motivating these inequalities particularly well. I just want you to know that they exist. And the point being that in order to make it possible to have a solution that has the properties that I wish to have, all I have to do is choose a particular case with potential that satisfies these inequalities. So by designing the potential correctly, I can ensure that there's a self-consistent solution that has the behavior that I wish. And we will do an example. Before going on to the example, though, there's a little bit more formalism that I want to go through. We're in pretty good shape on time. One very convenient thing is that we can rewrite the equation for motion in a particularly useful form. So h squared is equal to 8 pi 3 m Planck squared 1 half phi dot squared plus d phi pi double dot. All right. Here's the trick that we're going to do. Is notice that we're going to be looking at field evolution somewhere near the maximum of the potential, right? So this field is going to be rolling off this hill. So for phi monotonic, that is for a non-oscillatory solution, one that's just evolving away from the maximum of the potential, we can essentially use the scalar field itself as a clock, right? So we can change our dynamical variable from time t to the value of the scalar field itself, because there's a one-to-one mapping between the field value and the time. Make sense? Now, I'll leave it for you as kind of an interesting exercise in these equations of motion to show that if phi is monotonic, I can rewrite h of t as h is a function of the field. And these equations of motion become equivalent to the following. And h squared of phi 1 minus 1 third epsilon of phi is equal to 8 pi 3 m Planck squared v of phi, where epsilon is defined to be m Planck squared 4 pi h prime of phi or h of phi squared. This is a difficult exercise. I haven't seen it done before. Why would I write these equations of motion in this sort of bizarre-looking way? The reason is that this parameter epsilon ends up being physically a very important and significant variable, because you can also show that and the way you do this is, now remember that ADT is 1 over phi naught b d phi. Okay? So basically all you do is you take these equations and you rewrite them in terms of the time derivatives, in terms of derivatives with respect to this field. Okay? This is useful because you can write the equation of state for the scalar field exactly without making any assumptions about any sort of slow rolling behavior. This P is equal to rho times 2/3 epsilon phi minus 1. And therefore, you can write the equation for the acceleration is h squared root of phi 1 minus epsilon of phi. So immediately you have that a double dot over a being greater than 0, or p is less than minus 1/3 rho exactly corresponds to this parameter epsilon being less than 1. You will not often see this derived in the literature this way. Most of the time, this parameter epsilon is derived already in the slow roll approximation. But it's easy to make contact with sort of the more normal way of defining this in that in the limit that we have a slowly rolling field, which is where we're going to be working almost all the time, in slow roll, remember we have h squared is equal to 8 pi 3 m flux squared 1/2 phi dot squared plus v of phi, right? Here's our exact Friedman equation. If I take slow roll, I'm essentially taking that thing to be 0. So that means that h as a function of the field phi is just very simply related to potential for Planck squared times v of phi. Okay? These things you can derive exactly. They do not make any, you don't have to assume that phi dot is small in order to derive these equations. But in the limit that phi dot is small, h becomes trivially a function of the field phi because it only depends on the potential. And this is, you know, approximately constant time. And then this equation of state parameter, epsilon, becomes approximately equal to m Planck squared over 16 pi v prime of phi over v of phi squared. And in order for inflation to work, this has to be much less than 1. And you can see, actually, that this ends up being very closely related to this inequality that I just stated without proof. Okay. So now we have to have accelerating expansion, we need this to be true. The first derivative of the potential relative to the value of the potential itself has to be a small number. So we're at or near the maximum, some sort of false vacuum. Right? The potential has to look, we have to be up here somewhere. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Questions? For any given value of the slope, that is correct. I can make epsilon small by making the potential higher. Right. Right. Yes.
And how much of the plateau of the maxima must be large to have inflation?
It turns out in practice that it doesn't have to be all that big. You do end up with a fine-tuning in that the field has to be very, very, very close to its maximum. Okay? So that generically like a 1 minus m squared phi squared potential will work. But then you end up, observationally, you end up putting constraints on the parameters, and we'll talk a little bit about that. In the last 10 minutes here, what I want to do is define one more kind of a important term here and talk about other, well, in the last 10 minutes, I want to do this. Yes.
I thought the probability that the king will summon with a Lunanian and not low roll.
What about timeline?
Yes.
You have to be careful that the time scales involved are such that that won't happen. And right here, we're considering a purely classical solution at this point. So tunneling will be an intrinsically quantum mechanical process. So we really can't say much about that until we quantize the field. Original models of inflation, Guth's first model of inflation actually had a potential that looked like this, with the field sitting in a false vacuum here, and inflation actually ended by tunneling. So it would sit here, and the lifetime of this state would tell you how long inflation would continue, and then it would tunnel out of it into another state, right? So essentially what happens is you have to have the lifetime of this false vacuum be large enough to get as much inflation as you need. These models didn't work because there was no way to self-consistently repopulate the universe. Remember at the beginning today we said you need to do two things. You need to generate a vacuum-like energy, and you need to you also need to have inflation and the vacuum decay into radiation. It turns out that that second criterion, the decay of the vacuum into radiation, did not function right in these kind of models. That's the reason why they were abandoned fairly quickly for these slowly rolling models where you're rolling off the coupling potential. But if you work out the tunneling rate, there's no real issue here.
Do you have zero roll off with that? Do you have the timing and then the zero roll?
There are, in the sort of mid-90s, late-90s, there were back when before the cosmological constant was discovered, everybody, it was very popular to do what were called open inflation models that would give you omega 0.3 or so. And they built them exactly that way, where you would have a false vacuum that would decay, and then a short period of slow roll here, and you would tune that period of slow roll to make omega to be whatever you wanted it to be in the current universe. Such models, now that we know omega is one, have fallen out of favor because they're very complex. And you don't really need them. But yeah, you're right, you can do it, and it's called open inflation. So let's take a look at this kind of a slow roll solution, where essentially we have a scalar field that's evolving somewhere near the maximum of the potential. And I think the example that I have in my notes, the scalar field is going to be nowhere near the maximum potential. It's more like the kind that you suggested, where we just make V very big. But let's consider this for the moment. Essentially, we have that H is approximately equal to V, but because the field isn't moving, this thing is roughly a constant in time, right? So the solution is going to be that A of T is going to be somewhere approximately given by e to the h times t, right? It's just going to be an exponentially expanding universe. In the limit that phi dot goes exactly to zero, then this term becomes a constant in time, and we have the limit of De Sitter space that we talked about earlier, right? So that we have a way to non-trivially achieve exactly the kind of example that I showed you in the first lecture, just by taking the extreme slow roll limit here, by having the field just sitting there. Or more to the point, if I have a vacuum like this with some non-zero V naught, and I have a field sitting at the bottom of it, then I end up with exponential expansion. A step function. Well, sure, yeah. The potential, you mean? Yeah. Which actually turns out to be, yeah, you can do it. It turns out to be a rather interesting inflation model. I wrote some papers about that about a year ago. Right. It turns out that just about any function you want to pick has a limit that will work. Now, in the limit where phi dot is not identically equal to zero, we still have a solution of this form, but basically what we can do is a kind of adiabatic approximation where for slow roll, with phi dot not as equal to zero, we can take A proportional to the exponent of the integral of h of t with respect to t, which I will define to be e to some number n. This actually, this is not any particular solution at all. This is just an identity, right? This is a solution to h is equal to a dot over a, means that we can always write a in that form no matter what the time dependence of h is, right? But if h is slowly varying, it's going to be something that looks like an exponential in time. If h is rapidly varying, this expression will not actually be an exponential, look like e to the ht, right? So this is just simply another way of rewriting this differential equation. And now we can use this slow roll expression for h to rewrite that integral. So this number of e folds n is integral h dt is equal to the integral of h phi dot d phi, where I've just changed my variable of integration from time to the field value, is equal to 2 pi over m Planck integral d phi over the square root of epsilon phi, where epsilon is given by this expression, or in this case, in slow roll this expression. Right, all I've done here is plugged in essentially this expression for h, and then I end up with something in terms of that epsilon term. Okay? Is, in terms of the potential, 8 pi over m Planck squared integral d of phi over d prime of phi. And I'm leaving the limits on this integral deliberately vague because it's a technical detail that we don't have to care about too much right now. The point being that if I have epsilon much, much less than 1, if this parameter is very small, which means I have a very inflationary equation of state, if I'm close to p is equal to minus rho, that means that I automatically get lots and lots of e folds of inflation, a great deal of expansion. So a small epsilon means that I'm going to have a very long inflationary period automatically. So all of this hangs together beautifully. Basically, if I have a potential that gives me an equation of state, that gives me an accelerating expansion, that means I have to have this parameter small. If that parameter is small, I have a slowly rolling solution, so I can write h of phi like this, then this is determined entirely by the potential. And as long as that thing is small, since the amount of expansion I get per unit time is given by 1 over the square root of this parameter, I also tend to have a universe that's expanding very rapidly, and I get lots and lots and lots of inflation. OK, that makes it just about an hour and a half. Next time, we'll do a concrete example of all of this.